I need to be out the door in an hour and a half.
You need to be out the door in an hour and a half.
Yes, out the door. Because I rented this room for 2 hours.
This is our level of commitment to our audience. Or rather, oh, your level of commitment to the audience. I would have just blown everything off and just said, yeah, we'll do it some other time.
No way. We have to go every 2 weeks. Next week, I'm going to be gone in the Amazon. I can't ditch you.
Wait, are we finally doing the Jungle Podcast? Please tell me we're doing the Jungle Podcast.
Dude, I can totally bring my stuff. Yes, we could try to do that.
Oh, we're going to have monkeys on the show. Gonna have a monkey on the show.
We already have monkeys on the show every week, Todd.
Welcome to the Maximize This Podcast, the only podcast that will never, ever give you up. And most importantly, never, ever let you down.
This week we're going to talk about swing votes. Also, what is corruption? And our weekly Trump date.
Oh, man. I got a lot of grist for the mill on that one. I guess before we get to that, you are recording from an undisclosed location this week, or at least yes. Undisclosed to me.
I've given you several clues within the past 2 weeks. Have you been able to figure it out?
Have you noticed in the country you are in a bunch of people mindlessly staring at their phones all day as they wander around aimlessly looking for virtual monsters?
No, that's a very good question. And the answer is not yet.
Okay, so I can eliminate most of North America, Western Europe. We're talking about Pokemon Go here, I'm sure everyone.
We are, yes, yes. I can tell you that half of my purpose here is job hunting.
Job hunting?
Mm-hmm.
You go back to Argentina?
I did! I went back to Argentina. Nice. My very first day here, when I was red-eyed and tired, I went to an alumni meetup that happens once a month. And there, I met a couple of people who were already offering me jobs. So that was great. These jobs would be, roughly speaking, in think tanks or government.
These are in the Argentinian government, or these are broader South American?
Nope, Argentinian government. So I actually then met with a BCGer from my former company yesterday. Of all the options that this BCGer gave me, 5 of them sounded really enticing, and 2 of the 5 were with the people that I had met that very first day.
That sounds pretty lucky, if you ask me.
What are you up to?
Well, let's see. Since last we spoke, we took a trip down to Phoenix, Arizona to visit some relatives, a city that has the opposite problem of Minneapolis, in which they are also inhospitable outside 6 months out of the year, but it's the summer and not the winter.
That bad, huh?
So we enjoyed triple-digit temperatures every day while we were there. It was funny because, like, I wanted to go running while I was still there, and, you know, it doesn't get below, you know, the 80s, even in the morning. And my aunt and uncle were very concerned that I would perish from dehydration. I was fine. I survived.
Good. So you did it every day?
I think I did 2 out of the 4 days. Like, came in the afternoon, like 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Thursday. I'm like, all right, I'm going to go for a run. And they're like, it's 115 hours. You can't go for a run. I'm like, oh. So it was a fun trip. Now we're just preparing for a back-to-back-to-back series of visitors. Everyone visits us in the summer and not the winter for understandable reasons. We're booked solid all the way through August. I don't know when I'm going to have time to, you know, edit podcasts between now and then.
Because you do all the editing.
I do much of the editing with creative feedback support from my co-host.
I like how 98% is much. Yeah, I agree with that metric. So what are we talking about, Todd?
We're talking about swing voters here. And this whole phenomenon of a swing voter really confuses me because I feel like the two political parties, the two major political parties in the United States right now, their platforms are so far apart that it seems obvious what you're getting if you go one way or another. And so the fact that there are still people that struggle to decide between the two is confusing to me. And a study I read recently on the Washington Monthly sort of backs this up. They say that we're down to about maybe 4% of people that can be truly considered ideologically independent, that don't lean one way or another when it comes to voting.
Just to be clear, when you say this 4% of voters, do you include independents?
When they talk about independent in the context of this study, I think they mean people who don't affiliate with the Democratic or Republican Party. They may affiliate themselves with a third party, or they may be truly independent.
Okay. So there are 4% of the United States citizens who really don't affiliate themselves with Republican or Democratic parties, even though maybe 10% or some other number actually vote third party. The number that really say they don't have a leaning ideologically is only 4%.
Yeah, I would say the ones whose views are up for grabs, like enough up for grabs to, you know, be considered an actual swing voter would be 4%.
Got it.
I'm curious, what's the decision-making process look like of a person who struggles to decide one way or the other?
How is it that a Republican could be considering Hillary? That doesn't make sense to you, right?
Or certainly the other direction, where you have Democrats who are considering to vote for Trump.
Right. How is that even possible?
Right. That makes no sense to me.
Okay. I'll tell you why it makes sense. So first of all, I'm pretty in the middle person that liked Reagan principles, grew up in an immigrant family, and tended to lean in that direction. But how can I be sort of quote-unquote Republican but want to vote for Hillary? Which is maybe what's happening to me. First, his policies I'm agreeing with less and less, particularly foreign policy, particularly since I lived in the Middle East. Yes, terrorism is a threat, but their policy solutions for it treat all Muslims in this bucket as sort of this scary thing or this enemy or someone to look at differently. And having lived in that area and having a lot of friends, this is basically an attack on my friends. So really, like, the ideology that people talk about for the parties, I think relates more to domestic policy. So I might still agree more with Republican domestic policy than Democrat. But in this election cycle, foreign policy trumps domestic. Whereas Hillary's foreign policy, like, I just, maybe she is a little bit too interventionist, but I think it's still more safe than the wild card that Trump could be.
So you would say that you agree in general with, like, conservative principles, but that they're not being well represented by the current Republican candidate, or they're being represented weakly along with some policies and positions that you really disagree with on the foreign policy side.
So when you say conservative, you kind of mean on the right, with this bucket of things that typically comes with conservatism. And when you say liberal, you mean kind of on the left with this other bucket of things. I don't think it's a two-dimensional thing like this with a line. I think it's more like an eight-line spider chart where you have a whole bunch of different attributes. For instance, foreign policy, domestic policy, overemphasis of Keynesian growth versus overemphasis of free markets, right?
Mm-hmm.
Relative things. There's a lot of things. Conservative tends to kind of mean a certain bucket, but I don't think that label really means anything anymore. Because there are so many, I'm fiscally conservative but socially liberal. And even those two words encompass a whole bunch of policies that you can mix and match. So the first reason it doesn't make sense is because we're labeling Trump and Republicans as one word that no longer means anything. The simple way of saying this is there's kind of two factions now within the Republican Party. The sort of institutional, traditional group, kind of led by Mitt Romney now, who rebels against Trump and thinks he's taking the wrong direction. And then the ultra-conservative that Trump is trying to embody, despite having been Democrat in the past, or more liberal in the past.
So how much of this do you think is a consequence of the sort of what you alluded to, this sort of fissure within the Republican Party, that you actually have like two ideas of what conservatism is, and they're sort of branching in different directions, like they lead you to different conclusions, and they're both included within this bucket called the Republican Party, but they don't at all represent the same, they're not at all reflected in the same policies.
You can say that a simplification of this confusion is that you now have these two emerging camps within a party that have kind of different perspectives and goals. It's representative of the fact that many people may have different perspectives, and even former quote-unquote Republicans may bifurcate into yet a third group that's even going towards what's currently the Democratic side.
Mm-hmm.
However, I would say even the splitting in two is not a cause. It's more of a manifestation of the fact that you have, like I keep saying, eight or some number of different individual aspects of running a country that for some reason we as humans simplify and put a few sets of point of view into one bucket and we call it one platform. But really there's two different options or five different options on each of eight things. So it's impossible to say there's only two distinct platforms. There's about two to the eight distinct platforms a person could have.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I like to compare this to this thing called conjoint analysis in marketing. Have you heard of that term before?
I have not. You're going to have to explain it to me.
Oh, it's great. It's great. It's one way of doing market testing and trying to understand what consumer desires are. Let's say you have eight attributes of a car, all right? A car, one attribute is the body type. It could be a sedan, it could be convertible, it can be SUV. Another attribute is the color. Another attribute is stick shift or manual, and so on. So they'll pairwise show two different combinations of cars to a person, and the person just says A or B. So one is a red convertible stick shift, and the other one is a white SUV, Range Rover. And between the two, you may generally have a preference for a convertible, but you may also love Range Rover as a brand.
Mm-hmm.
So you may actually pick Range Rover. But then in other combinations, you might pick the convertible. Or in other combinations, you might pick the one that's manual over stick shift when you don't actually care about the other six variables that are there. You do this pairwise for about 100 different pairs that are all different. You understand?
Yes, I do.
And then in the end, like, you may generally have a set of preferences of a few attributes over the others, but the overall combination of stuff, this one may rise over the other. And in the end of this whole analysis, it tells you what your actual, like, preferences are.
I like this. Are you aware of any attempts to do this with voters?
No, but that's a great idea for a research project. Maybe I'll look. I'll see if it exists.
Because that would be interesting. And I don't disagree with you. Like, I think the division of every issue into a kind of left and right perspective is just a consequence of our two-party system here. Like, I think you would probably see different combinations of positions on policies if we had, you know, either a more parliamentary system or a different voting system. But
right.
I agree with what you're saying. Like, I think that makes sense that we're sort of forced into making this false dilemma, false choice between two options, even if the positions taken by one or the other candidate don't align perfectly with what we want to do.
Exactly. And to be specific for this, I actually tried to list out, as I was thinking about this question, where my preferences are coming from this time around. And so I made six buckets. So one is basically domestic policy. Two is foreign policy. So those two are just platforms, ideologies. Three is ability to day-to-day execute and keep the country running, which is just like any CEO has a lot of thankless work because it's actually really hard to keep everything going. Four is the ability to execute on those big policy items like the first, number one, number two, like Obama's big promise about Obamacare. Five, lacking any hot button issues, because that'll sway your vote a lot, right? Mm-hmm. Even if the others are aligned. And then six, someone who kind of sounds and feels like a role model. Okay. So for me, Hillary wins on the foreign policy, number two. Number three, the day-to-day execution, because I think that one of her strengths is listening and assimilating what people are telling her and coming up with policy to act. It's keeping the mechanism going and creating relationships. A lot of this stuff is thankless because then people say, oh, she didn't accomplish anything. She can't point to one thing she did, which that was number four, which is execution of the big things. But number three is just as important, how to keep the thing going. It's definitely a criteria.
Plus, she has like decades of experience working within, you know, the government system.
Yes. And then the other one is lack of hot button issues. I mean, there are things I disagree with in her platform, but none of them are as hot button to me as the ones that Trump hits. So she wins on 2, 3, and 5. And then as a role model, I know people don't like her when she speaks, but I think that's just, we should have another episode about females in the workplace and double standards and those things. But I think she could be a role model. Whereas Trump fails on, for me, number one, domestic policy, number two, foreign policy, number five, hot button issues, and number six, sounds and feels like role model. And then I don't have a lot of evidence for him on number three and four, which is the execution. So when I look at it that way, you can kind of ideologically agree with somebody, but when he's drifting away from the ones you care about the most and then has all these other negatives, you'll consider somebody else with a different combination of things, even though what you would assume is the most important, the policy stuff, doesn't quite align. But everything else, you know, there's a lot of things that make up for it. Kind of like we were talking about last week with policy versus personality. in a way.
This system that you've outlined here it's really interesting to me. And it's also something that's confirming another statistic that came out of the study that I read, which was that, you know, contrary to popular belief, you know, moderate or independent or undecided swing voters are not that way because of apathy or ignorance. If you look at them as a group, most of them are, you know, more educated than the typical voter and, you know, more politically involved and aware of what's going on than the typical voter as well. So that's, I think, a common misperception. And it's also been borne out by, I've been made aware since we last talked of other people who are in this sort of swingy subgroup. The other people I've known are also like people that spend a lot of time thinking about politics and are, you know, very up to date on the issues and informed and educated about them. And so when I encounter situations like this that go contrary to my intuition, I have to reevaluate what I, you know, whether my position is true or false. And while there's more of an alignment between my preferences and at least one of the candidates, I can see a little bit better now that that's not the case for everyone. And so you're not weird.
I think we should talk about corruption next.
Okay.
But you? That'd be great.
That would be good.
It'd be great to define corruption first. Corruption is exemplified by a very wide variety and diverse array of phenomena, of which bribery is only one kind. Nepotism is another.
Are you reading from a dictionary?
I am. Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophies. They're saying that there isn't an easy way to define it.
It's not. This is motivated from like some conversations that you had with people recently about, you know, your observations of corruption in various systems or...
So recently, I was talking with a Colombian friend about corruption, kind of how all pervasive it is and how to stop it. He keeps bringing it back to income and to redistribution as a way to solve it. And every time I propose this whole other system of what's going on, he's like, yeah, I agree, but income. Don't forget income. So I've just been thinking a lot. I wanted to prove him wrong, and so I started writing this really, really long post. And I realized it's not an easy thing to understand. And one of the reasons is that people use this word to mean a whole lot of different things anytime that there's a problem with the system. And it helps us keep things straight in our mind, I suppose, to have these labels. But then it also masks what's the actual mechanism going on, because there's different ones in different places. And then you need to understand those mechanisms to be able to propose a solution.
So just as an introduction, you're making the case that the word corruption is, it's too broad an umbrella, right? Like the things you would do to address nepotism are different than the things you would do to address bribery are different than the things you would do to address.
Yeah, to an extent. And there's different players. There's government actors. There's the individual who can't afford a lot. There's a lot of different situations. I created this massive framework of 10 different points of view of how to think about corruption. And I think that's way too long for 10 podcasts. So yeah. Let me just pick out a couple.
Our next 10 episodes will be each of Dinah's investigations.
10 theories of corruption. But I'll pick out a couple that I think might be, I don't know, commonly held beliefs that I disagree with and see what you think.
I'd love to hear it.
All right. The first one, equal poverty levels do not equal amounts of corruption necessarily. So you might say that it's really highly linked to the level of disparity of the population and the level of power. That when you have inequality, the more people have more money, the more they can buy whatever power and privilege that they want. And that's going to be true across societies. My counterpoint is you can have one society more corrupt than another, even though they have same poverty, same inequality, because the history, just for coincidence sake, one of them had more corruption in the past and corruption is sticky. The beliefs of the people and its ability to change, which I'll get to later, actually. Trust in the leaders. You know, you can have a poor society, but for some reason you trust the leaders are going to do the right thing. The society's ability to change and kind of react to shocks and scandals and still adjust versus maybe culturally they're not able to do so.
So you're making the case that there are lots of cultural factors that are more relevant than just the poverty level alone of a country.
Yes, I should frame it that way. There's cultural factors, there's history of the country itself, and then there's institutions. One additional cultural factor is the moral compass of its people. So take two equally poor nations, and one has a very strong moral compass. They're just going to be less likely to break laws, even if they really feel the need to. And then government institutions, rule by law, consistent and predictable prosecution of anyone that behaves badly. You might say that inequality will tend to corrupt those things over time and it's hard to sustain. But given that the institutions are there, you're going to have lower corruption.
So like as an extreme example, if you look at North Korea.
Oh, my favorite country. I've been there.
If you have a country where you have a... You know, certainly the poverty level is very high and the income disparity between people is also high. You would expect to see some level of corruption among the people, but since the authoritarian system, the system of law and order there and policing is so strict that there would be less corruption there than you might otherwise expect because they have a very strong system of order in place.
Yes, you just did the physics thing. That's wonderful. You took an extreme example.
I bet this is two episodes in a row now I've taken your approach.
I've either rubbed off on you or you're stealing my thunder. I'm not sure.
I have a science background as well. I'm not afraid of using these techniques.
My friend has a good point, which is the more you have a select set of people with power and money, the more they're going to, I guess, degrade the institutions or they have the ability to by creating more and more corruption. So maybe the inevitable outcome is that they tend towards the same poverty level? That could be. That's the only question in my mind. So I have three questions. There we go. Question number one. How much corruption do you believe is attributable to the fact that it's actually there and systemic and happening a lot versus that people believe that it's there and will never change?
Oh, you're saying, so like if I perceive that, you know, a country or an organization is corrupt, whether it is or it isn't, it makes it more likely for me to engage in acts that would be considered corrupt.
That's one mechanism. Like I talk to people here, I talk to people in Colombia, I talk to people in Argentina, and they're equally, I'm not really sure which one's more corrupt, but they all say it in the same way. Government's corrupt. This country's corrupt. You really can't survive as a business unless you evade taxes or unless you do all of these informal things. Because if you did all of the laws, if you followed them all, you would have to shut down. And it's just how things work.
I think context is huge. I would say that the perception of corruption is a major influencer on the actual level of corruption in the country. It's like if you go through a subway station and it's immaculate and clean, then you're not going to throw garbage on the floor or spray paint a wall, because it's clear that people pay attention to the, you know, cleanliness of this place, and your actions will be influenced by that context. But if it's, you know, if there's trash all over the floor and, you know, people have tagged all the cars, then that's, other people are going to also throw trash on the ground or put their own tags up or whatever that is, because they see that, oh, this behavior is apparently acceptable. Like other people have done this and gotten away with it. I can do this as well with no consequence.
Exactly. You know, we could even test this. We could sociologically test this by creating a VR glasses, kind of like the Pokemon Go thing. And in one version, you see trash everywhere. In the other version, you don't. The trash is fake in the one where we see it everywhere. And then you just compare how many tons of trash get thrown versus don't. And they could, to simulate corruption, you could say, oh, it's a lot harder to not throw it on the ground because there aren't that many trash bins. So let's say that we take out a lot of trash bins and people now have to go search for one. Mm-hmm. So we make it not easy to do the clean thing.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be interesting?
It is. I think context and perception of this is huge. I think that's a very big deal.
Okay. So beliefs are important. I think that Macri, the new president of Argentina, is a lot less corrupt than the previous administration. He's bringing in a whole bunch of business leaders, which I believe in, a lot of people don't, as a good way to create a better organization that follows the rules. And I think he could clean up corruption. But one of the big problems he has is convincing everybody that he's actually going to change it. And as long as they don't believe it, they're not going to hold leaders accountable, and they're not going to change their own behaviors. So it kind of takes this whole system redesign for everybody to all of a sudden start believing that it could be different and acting differently at the same time.
If you have leaders that have been corrupt in the past, and when new ones come in on a platform of, oh, I'm going to clean up this place, and then they don't, like that happens enough over time and the population becomes cynical. And even when you finally get someone who would presumably actually clean up the system, whatever that means, it's difficult for them to convince people, no, this time I mean it.
So here's another question.
Yes.
Question number two. Do you think South America is more corrupt than the United States? Or is it the same? If you take into account, quote unquote, institutional corruption, where people bend the laws in their favor to get what they want and to get power.
So you have to sort of normalize for the size of the economy. Like the United States economy is so much bigger than the South American economies. If you have, you know, 1% corruption rate in the United States, how much more corrupt do you need to be in South America to get the same dollar level of corruption? Does that make sense?
Oh, let's say purchasing power parity adjusted.
Yeah, okay.
And so standard of living adjusted.
Sure. Why not? I feel like from a business perspective, I think that it is way less corrupt in America than it is in South America. I don't obviously have any firsthand experience doing business in... That's actually not true. I was actually... I visited Brazil 3 times for business.
You were bribing people? When? What?
No. Sorry.
So from never to 3 times. Interesting, Todd. What are you hiding?
Nothing.
Why did you say that wrong?
I don't know. But while I was there, at no point did I have to engage in any kind of corrupt activities while I was there. And neither have I had to do so in the Americas. So it's 0-0 as far as my personal experience has shown.
Interesting. I don't think I have either in Colombia or Argentina. That's a good question. Although not having run a business yet, I think, and not having to like rent an apartment or do any legal stuff.
Maybe this is stuff that happens, you know, just outside. Maybe that by definitionally you don't see corruption, but, you know, people that I know that own businesses or run businesses or, you know, I never hear, oh, I got to pay off this government official in order to get this or that done. Like, that's essentially unheard of. at least at the small business level, maybe maybe when you start talking about larger businesses and the lobbying that you were referring to, like if someone needs to get a permit to build a new power plant or run cable or what have you, that they have to contribute to a person's campaign to get their vote. I mean, yeah, that's something I can imagine happening. But at least on a day-to-day business level, at a small business level, I don't perceive that there is hardly any corruption like that.
Well, here's the thing. That's exactly what the point is, I think. As you become more developed or industrial a nation, what I've heard people refer to is that corruption is institutionalized. So in other words, you have laws that you're following, technically speaking, but you find a way to use the law in order to gain the influence via money. So for instance, when you're lobbying, I mean, that is a big thing. Like, you're not going to be paying a guy to bribe him for something, but indirectly you find a way to give him something or money or power or favors in order to get that thing. But since there's rule by law, you know that you can't do it as overtly.
Mm-hmm.
So there are systems in place to try to prevent corruption, but there's a lot of ways around the systems. And companies lobby like crazy to get laws that are passed slightly more in their favor to save them money. And that counts too, I think.
Sure.
I used to think that there was hardly any corruption in the US at all. And now I think I've changed to think that it's a version that is more accepted because it's following a set of laws. And we think as long as you're basically following the law, you're okay.
Yeah. It's like cloaked in this veneer of legitimacy because,
yes,
because it's being, you know, tacitly supported by the government. Like, I mean, if the government has a no-bid contract, you know, awarding hundreds of millions of dollars to this or that company to provide a service, you could perceive that to be a kind of corruption.
Exactly.
I know a lot of people have the perspective that, like, you know, the entire Iraq war in the 2000s was like a giant, you know, money handover to Halliburton. And that's sort of what I was trying to talk about earlier about, you know, normalizing the scale. I mean, while it doesn't affect us on a day-to-day basis, that's a lot of money that's exchanging hands in a corrupt way.
Yes. And this brings me to my third question, actually, is how do you tell the difference between the perception of corruption and actual corruption? So if anytime you see a perceived conflict of interest, it's easy to say, oh, Hillary gets all these speaking deals and there is lack of transparency in XYZ transaction. And she made a deal with some country at the same time she got a donation. Clearly she's corrupt. But it's really easy to point to things as corruption or the Halliburton example, but it's a lot harder to be certain. It could be that the best interest of the country was to make this deal. And in return, they were grateful and donated to her, you know, to her foundation.
Mm-hmm.
This could be a story. It could also be that that was part of the deal to make it happen. But still, it doesn't mean that it wasn't, in her judgment, the best thing for the country, right? In the Halliburton example, having worked in defense, I know it's really hard to mobilize a very, very large project quickly. And sometimes you have to downselect for political reasons. Sometimes you downselect to a final contractor because you know the person in charge and you know that they'll be able to execute quickly. And you need someone for the country that's going to be able to execute reliably and quickly with high priority. And like, if it were me and there was no worrying about appearance, I might have selected Halliburton just because I knew they would be quick and the best. But then you get political fallout because nobody can tell the difference between that and corruption.
Yeah, and I think it's also a question of, are the things that we're paying Halliburton to do actually value added? Or are they just, you know, building structures in the middle of nowhere that are serving no purpose, but still collecting, you know, their, I don't know if they were flat fee or, you know, cost plus or whatever. But that's another way. Like, yes, maybe Halliburton was the only company to do some of these things, but did we really need to be doing those things to begin with? It's like, the best example I saw was, and this goes back to South America, but there's a, I can find a picture. It's actually really good. There was a bridge that was constructed over just this very corner of a lake. It's not even a lake, like a pond, that clearly no road was needed. Like, you could just go 100 meters, you know, to the left and make it around this lake. But they built this bridge over this. And so clearly, like, someone got a payout to their construction company to build this bridge where no bridge was actually needed. And so, like, maybe that company was the only one in the area that could have done that. But did you really need to do that? That's corrupt as far as I'm concerned.
I agree. What happens here a lot is that the government passes a bill for a road that needs to be constructed. It would actually cost $50 million, but it goes for $100. And that extra $50 goes into the pockets of a bunch of people.
Yeah, no, that sounds yeah, plausible.
Oh, yes. Oh, and the other day, this is a really good example. And, sometimes it's unclear when it's corrupt or not. But actually, one of my Airbnb hosts a few months ago used to be a lawyer for the government. She was in the auditing department. and quit because she was so disgusted by the processes that were happening. They basically, in the auditing department, would find inconsistencies, spell them out, document them, and here you go. Like, for instance, oh, there was an over budget by $30,000. Here you go, legislature. Now you can go figure this out. Or you know, let's go process this, government. Please take this piece of paper and do whatever you're going to do with this inconsistency. So then they would take this to the floor, this piece of paper, and say, okay, here's the next one. How are we going to make this one go away? Yeah, you're going to give that much money to... Okay, great. Tear it up. Done. That's how they processed inconsistencies and corruption by more corruption. So hopefully that's changing. Who knows? I'm optimistic that it can.
Speaking of corruption...
Oh my God, RNC.
The Republican National Convention is this week. It's Wednesday now, so they're, I guess, at least half done. I haven't tuned in at all today to see what's going on, but and Tuesday was relatively boring. But Monday we had some excitement.
Colbert said something. I didn't watch the whole RNC thing, but I obviously watched Colbert's reaction to it and his little performance. But is it true that the nominee isn't even supposed to show up the first day?
I don't know. I know I heard that he like made a big appearance, but is this like a superstition that it's good for them to not show up? We could probably look this up. Did Barack Obama show up in 2008? I don't remember.
I'm not clear, but the idea is that when they're not nominee yet, you know, when you start the RNC, technically the roll call hasn't happened and they haven't yet picked the person. Mm-hmm. They're not supposed to open the thing with Eye of the Tiger or whatever it was. Sorry. No, we are the champions.
Oh, yes.
Trump walking into that song.
I mean, has there been anything traditional or conventional about his candidacy so far? Why are we surprised by this? I mean, tradition just goes out the window.
What do you think of Pence, his running mate?
I think the most interesting thing is that he brought someone who endorsed another candidate in the primaries onto his team. I haven't seen a more vindictive candidate in modern history. And so the fact that he would forgive such a trespass is impressive to me. What do I think about him, like, you know, as a choice? You know,
strategically.
He's probably, he makes too much sense, is what I would say. Like, it's almost surprising that he would make this pick and not someone more outlandish. I mean, he's the governor of a, you know, solidly red Midwestern state. He brings a lot of conservative gravitas to the ticket that might have been otherwise lacking for some of the social conservatives out there. He doesn't have any like major scandals or, you know, history to draw attention to, other than I think in recent memory, one of those religious freedom bills saying that businesses who didn't want to provide to gay customers could be.
But they undid that later. You realized it was a mistake.
They passed it and then they watered it down. So I think it's still there, but it wasn't as strict as it ended up being. Anyway, so yeah, like he's, you know, a perfectly reasonable choice, you know, and as much as the vice president, you know, matters to the ticket, it's not crazy, so there's not a whole lot to talk about.
So do you remember back in, oh, I don't know, November, January of this past year, this past winter, I was like, Trump has a good chance of winning, and he's a smart strategist, and everyone says, but there's no way that his same demeanor and what he's doing now will sway the full set of voters come November. And the point is like, no, but right now he's doing the right strategy for the people that he's trying to woo. And then later he'll switch as needed because that's what he does. He reads the situation well and he reads people well. I think this Pence guy may be one of his smartest moves. For the things that you're saying, he has the opposite demeanor. So anybody who's a little afraid of Trump's crazy might be slightly less afraid now. He's conservative. So any of the people that were doubting Trump's conservative motives can feel a little safer also that he's locked down on his policies. And he's completely unknown for the most part, and so not much of risk of controversy coming out, other than the LGBT thing, the bill that you just said, which is already well known.
Yeah.
So if you do like a strategic analysis of Trump's strengths and weaknesses before the pick, I would say he had a few weaknesses in these areas, in you know, his crazy demeanor, his will he really be conservative, and then his, you know, his kind of controversial background statements, those things, and lack of respectability. And this guy fills all four of those. That's pretty smart, right?
It is smart if you perceive that the vice president is actually going to have an influence on the president. I mean, I think...
It's marketing.
Yeah, it's excellent, for sure. It's excellent marketing. Like, if you're a person who believes that having a quote-unquote balanced ticket like this, where you have a, you know, a solid, staunchly conservative person on the ticket as well as someone who's more out there. Like, as long as it's balanced either way and you feel good about that, then yes, it makes for very good marketing. Ah. I think you probably want to dig a little deeper and say Trump has not shown a lot of inclination to listen to anyone. And so whether he's actually going to take any, you know, advice from Pence on these positions is, you know, seems dubious.
Yeah, but Todd, what you're describing is rational thought process and policy. And remember, people win based on emotion and personality, and he has just filled in his weaknesses in personality.
You are correct.
And his emotional gut wrench is perfect. Yeah. He doesn't care about policy. He doesn't care about having that nailed down. His whole strategy is personality and appealing to people in the right way. Mm-hmm. So the people he was turning off, he brings in somebody that kind of makes them feel a little better.
It does make it a little harder, though, with moderates, though, right? Because now he's got, you know, someone who, for whom, oh, I'm, you know, I'm really glad to see a Republican who's not as, you know, vehemently anti-LGBT as some of the other candidates that were in the primaries. Oh, wait, now they've just brought this guy on the vice presidential ticket. I can't.
Right.
I can't do this anymore.
But you're still talking about swing voters, right? Whereas I think his strategy is to mobilize the people that are already pretty much in his camp.
Okay.
To get the numbers out.
So this
is a numbers game?
Yeah. This is targeted at Republicans who might stay home because they don't feel like the platform, they don't feel like the ticket is conservative enough, but now it is, mm-hmm. and so they'll actually go out and vote.
Yes.
Okay.
Or that may have not voted for him because they thought he was just a bit too brash or controversial.
No, I mean, I think it's a fine pick. Like, I think as far as these things go, it was a smart choice. It makes me, it's scary when he's actually, you know, you see these glimmers of, oh, he actually did something right this time. Let's hope he's back to his old self here soon.
What's your probability distribution right now for the outcome of the election?
I still think it's like 2-1 that Clinton wins.
You know that Trump's slightly ahead in the polls now.
National polls mean nothing at this point.
But everybody believes Nate Silver a year ahead of time when he says 0% chance.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, either polls are reliable for something. Either they're predictive or they're not. And so you're presenting a poll as an evidence and then saying, see, Nate Silver's poll was wrong. Like, either polls are right or they're wrong. Or sometimes they're right or sometimes they're wrong.
First of all, it can give you trends and you can read into the psychology of what's happening. Second of all, the closer to the election, the higher the probability of it being accurate.
But again, it's like not a national. We have the Electoral College, and so the national polls are basically irrelevant. I feel like any poll, like pre-convention, is also sort of, it's just, there's just going to be too much noise, right? Like, Trump will probably see a minor bump this week, and then Clinton will, you know, probably erase some or all of that the following week after the Democrats have their convention. Like, it's just...
Yeah, but dude, I can cherry pick whatever statistic I want to support my point.
Congratulations.
Right?
You've now earned a degree in statistics.
Yes!
Are we going to talk about... We're not going to talk about the speech at all. I don't actually...
Really. We were going to talk about... Oh, yeah.
Honestly, I think the speech is really a non-issue. It's one of those things that makes for great, like...
We're talking about, obviously, Trump's third wife who gave a speech and plagiarized part of Michelle Obama's speech from 8 years ago.
On the spectrum of things that the campaign has done already, like whether she, you know, plagiarized this or whether it was some kind of sabotage, like by the time this podcast airs, no one's going to be talking about this.
Plagiarism is bad. Please do not steal other people's work.
Mm-hmm. The only funny thing I think about the whole speech thing is that there was a line included in there about Trump never letting you down and never giving you up, which is, for those unfamiliar, an internet troll technique.
Rick rolls.
So that's what points to sabotage for me, that she didn't, someone gave her this speech and they hung her out to dry.
You don't think that was intentional? You don't think she put that in there because it would be a funny American culture thing?
There's zero chance that anyone from the Trump campaign has any knowledge of Rick rolling.
Why do people make blatant claims about this, about understanding what speechwriters think and assuming they're all stupid and not cultured? Everybody knows Rickroll.
I don't think the average American on the street knows what
Everybody
Rickroll
knows
is either.
Rickroll. I don't know what to say.
Think of something to say and we'll talk about it next week.
I think we should do that.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Maximize This podcast. As always, you can find the discussion page for this episode on Reddit at reddit.com/r/maximizethis. You can chime in with your point of view, any thoughts on what we talked about, and any ideas for future topics.
You can check out our website at www.maximizethis.fm. Please leave reviews on iTunes and tell your friends and let us know how you like the show.
And until next time, don't let pretty good be the enemy of perfect.
One more minute. Un minuto. That's me getting kicked out.